You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Number of opportunities for master's-level pharmacologists exist in the pharmaceutical industry, biotechnology companies, government agencies, research laboratories, and academic programs. Introducing the Master of Science in Pharmacology program from the University of California, Irvine, UCI. The knowledge acquired in the Master of Science in Pharmacology program would also benefit those seeking employment in industry or advancement in teaching, technical and scientific writing, patenting, or pharmaceutical sales and marketing. Fall registration is now open. Apply today at sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology to learn more and reserve your seat by June 15th, 2020. That's sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology and reserve your seat today. The deadline is June 15th, 2020.
This is the Evidence-Based Podcast. Evidence-based medicine integrates clinical experience and a patient-centered focus with the best available research information. It's a movement which aims to increase the use of high-quality clinical research in clinical decision-making. This podcast is dedicated to all healthcare providers with a thirst for scientific knowledge, those who are explorers, innovators, and researchers. Welcome to the Evidence-Based Podcast.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation. This is the host and founder of the Pharmacy Podcast Network, Todd Urey. I know that I always say I'm excited about the guests that we have, but I can't help it. You pharmacists and healthcare professionals are the champions, especially now in this time of our nation, the worldwide pandemic of COVID-19 and what's happening. Pharmacists are tweeting some of their challenges. Please do so and reach out to us and let us know if there's anything we can do from sourcing information for you. We've been doing some work for several colleges, universities of pharmacies to ask for health system pharmacists that want extra work in telemedicine in this virus disaster, and very interesting. So if you have any experience in phone counseling, telehealth counseling, reach out to the Pharmacy Podcast. Today is exciting. I am excited to say that Dr. Jeffrey Feuden is returning to the Pharmacy Podcast Nation for his fifth appearance. Jeff, welcome back to the Pharmacy Podcast.
Thank you so much, Todd. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. You first came on April of 2016 with the opioid prescribing guidelines use of pseudoscience, and that was a fun episode to listen to. I learned from you. I learn always when we're talking, and you did a series, helped us with the Avadem Health podcast series, and we did one on the impact of the opioid epidemic and pain management, and this kind of folds into that theme. There was a paper that you did, and you have a team of people that have participated in this. And before we talk about this paper regarding neuropathic pain in end-stage renal disease, and we will have show notes. In the show notes, we have some links to this information. Jeff, would you introduce your guest that you've brought with you today?
Sure. I'd like to first thank you, Todd, for reaching out to me. You are a pro. Either that or you're stalking me. You are a pro at finding some of the publications that I've been involved with. So I just want to say that the reason that you contacted me is because of this article that was published in January 20th, 2020, so just a couple months ago, entitled Pharmacotherapeutic Management of Neuropathic Pain in End-Stage Renal Disease. And so we had actually five authors on the paper. I was one of them. I am fortunate that two of them were able to join us today, one of them being Dr. Roy Matthew, who is actually a nephrologist, and myself and Dr. Wegman, who's here with us today as well, worked together for several years. So I will let Dr. Matthew introduce himself in just a minute. And then there's Dr. Erica Wegren, who still works side by side with me and is a clinical pharmacist. So I'm going to give each of them an opportunity to just introduce themselves real quick so that we know everybody that's here. So maybe let's start with Roy.
Sure. So thank you both for inviting me to this. As Jeff mentioned, I'm a nephrologist, and I currently work at the Columbia VA healthcare system in Columbia, South Carolina. But before my stint here, I was at the Albany VA Medical Center in Albany, New York, working with Jeff for the first 7 years after I left fellowship. And Jeff and I had started to work together because, you know, as we'll talk about in the podcast, chronic pain management was such a large part of our management of end-stage renal disease patients. As you can imagine, many quality of life issues are evident in patients with end-stage renal disease, and one of them is chronic pain. And we had addressed actually several issues related to that. At the time, opioids were such a big component of pain management, and pharmacokinetic issues in opioid use in end-stage renal disease had not been well delineated. And so we had published actually a couple of papers with Jeff and one of his colleagues on that issue. And Jeff had been very fortunate. I mean, you know, we were very fortunate to have his expertise there. He had been involved very specifically in managing pain and also monitoring the use of pain management in our dialysis population. And so our collaboration sort of progressed from there. And then, you know, our final paper most recently being the neuropathic pain. And so that's how our collaboration had developed. So that's a little bit about me and our working relationship.
Great. And how about Erica?
Hi, I just want to say thank you also again for including us today. As Jeff mentioned, I am a clinical pharmacist specializing in pain management at the Albany VA. And my background, I've been very fortunate to work with Jeff for a number of years now, starting as a student and progressing all the way through specialized residency. So we've done quite a bit of work together, and it's a really great team that he's put together here, and we really have a lot of fun working on these papers, so I think we'll have a great conversation today.
Jeff, as a non-pharmacist and someone who is attracted to how pharmacists are leveraged in the expense of healthcare, which has, you know, gone crazy over the last 20 years, and the world that we're going through in PBM reform to understand the dollars that are being spent on different disease states and conditions. Pain management has been the most hidden and most mysterious condition because of how many places it shows up. How many disease states it's a part of, and what it creates in the life of a patient that's going through it. And I've read a lot about pain management. Lots of it, I don't understand the pharmacokinetics of it or the pharmacology of it, but I do understand the human part of it. I went through some pain after an ATV accident, which lasted for about a year. And it took me some time to get through that, and it's not bothering me as much, but it was there, and I get it. I understand that, and I understand the empathy that needs to be part of this. But today is really about the science and the information that you sourced with your fellow authors on this paper about pain management in patients that are requiring that careful assessment of what's happening in their drug regimen and their drug therapies, the accumulation of those medications, their metabolisms, the way that they're breaking these medications down, the other factors that come into this. If someone's a diabetic, if someone's hypertension, there's so many things that a pharmacist, I feel like you have to juggle what's coming from the physician, what's coming from specialists. And it's up to the pharmacist to really make literal sense, scientific sense of the medications that that patient is experiencing ongoing. So, Jeff, I'm going to turn this episode over to you as the quarterback here and really building a discussion about this very impressive paper, which once again we'll have in the show notes, so that the pharmacist listening can really get something out of today's conversation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Todd. Let me start by sort of piggybacking on something that you said. Pharmacists really, there are multiple roles for pharmacists, as you well know, and the listeners well know. But a lot of times, I know that non-pharmacists listen on these podcasts, and I think it's really important for people to understand that there are other places for pharmacists to practice other than the community setting. Of course, the community setting is very important as well. But Erica and I have spent most of our career doing direct patient care. And as Roy mentioned, we collaborated and seeing patients quite often. And I feel like one of the biggest drawbacks right now in the profession is that pharmacists are not recognized by Congress as providers. And that's problematic, particularly with this climate of opioid misuse and abuse. And now with COVID-19, if Congress would see the forest through the trees and allow pharmacists to be providers by name, then pharmacists could bill for their services. So within the Department of Defense, the VA, Public Health Service, and any federal agencies, pharmacists are recognized as clinicians and providers, which means that they can do direct patient care. And I feel like, particularly for pain management, physicians, and Roy can comment on this, but physicians are really struggling with some of the issues that need to take place with patients who are being considered for chronic opioids. So there are millions of patients in this country that have chronic non-cancer pain. And interestingly, over 90% of all patients that have chronic kidney disease have pain. And of those over 90%, 35% of them have some kind of neuropathic pain. And of that 35%, 90% of them have some kind of peripheral neuropathy. Now, these patients need medications. So I think, you know, it's very important to recognize that. And I'm going to ask, so Erica has spent a lot of time working directly with Roy. So I'm going to ask Roy to chime in for a minute just to talk about the importance of collaboration between the pharmacy team and the medical team. And then we can talk more specifically about this article and how pharmacists could help influence prescribing habits and benefit the patient. So Roy, can you maybe just comment on you know, your experience working with a pharmacist, a clinical pharmacist team in these sure. patients and the importance of that?
Sure. So I think nephrology may be the ideal sort of participant here in this conversation, because nephrology has always been a field where pharmacy has had a very strong presence. And, you know, if you look at the literature, the renal literature, some of the, you know, some of the top papers out there are produced by PharmDs because of the strong collaboration that we have. Our patient population in particular has an incredible need for the collaboration that we have between physicians and pharmacists. And two big reasons for that is, number one, polypharmacy. This is a patient population that has a tremendous number of medications per patient. You know, if you're seeing on average 11 to 12 separate prescriptions per patient. And number two, being probably the more obvious, is the pharmacokinetic issues that come with any one of those medications in this patient population because of the reduced kidney function. So now you have an issue of impaired clearance, of course, only with those that are relying on renal clearance, and then the issue of drug-drug interaction. And to expect that one group of providers is going to be able to manage all of these different situations is a clear recipe for failure. And in this population, there's such a high risk for adverse events and adverse outcomes that to have a strong team that can keep an eye on each of those different aspects, that's what in part I think has led to the improvement in outcomes, even though not great, but definitely better than they were 10 to 20 years ago, and especially in the end-stage renal disease population. And that has carried over into the pre-dialysis population as well, with the team-based approach to managing, especially chronic kidney disease. And so I think in renal is an ideal example of how you can use different provider groups to provide optimal care for a very sick population. You know, I really do enjoy working with my pharmacy colleagues, and in part because I think they truly, you know, bring something to the table. I mean, the training is as rigorous, if at a time sometimes more rigorous, and so we bring similar backgrounds to the table, and it really is a joy to work with these guys.
Okay, great. So now I'm gonna since Todd made me the quarterback for this, I'm gonna throw a pass, lob a pass at Erica, and ask Erica if she can comment before we even get into some of the specifics about chronic kidney disease. If Erica maybe can just comment on some of the kinds of drug interactions that we see in these chronic kidney disease patients because of the multiple medications. So maybe talk briefly about the kinds of things that you see, like the CYP interactions and the plasma protein binding problems and that sort of thing. So Erica, maybe you can comment on that.
Sure, absolutely. I think that so often when we see these patients in our clinic, they can come through the door already on such a high number of medications, 20 plus medications, trying to manage all of their multiple comorbid disease states. So sort of as Jeff mentioned, we oftentimes are dealing with a lot of drug interactions that are involving metabolism, so the cytochrome P450 system. And what can happen is if we add certain drugs on board, then that can alter the metabolism another, and it could result in accumulation and toxicities. One of the, I'm sure we'll talk about it in a little bit, but one of the ways we've gotten around that is to focus on a phase two metabolism, because that is, I'd say, much less frequently used and has less strain. I mean, we also kind of look at, drug disease state, of course, interactions, and what a lot of individuals don't think about is the decline of other organ systems as well. And so by relying on phase two metabolism, we also take some of the strain off of the liver as well.
So that was a great lateral pass back to me, Erica, because of what I'm going to talk about next. But I just want to clarify one of the things that Erica mentioned. She talked about phase two metabolism. And so with the CYP metabolism, which is considered phase one, that's more difficult for the liver. And there's more drug interactions with phase one because it involves CYP metabolism. So Erica mentioned that if you add a medication or if a patient's on a medication, it could either lower the blood levels or raise the blood levels of medications on board or new medications. But even stopping some medications that affect the cytochrome system can raise or lower blood levels of the other drugs. And so in these patients that are on 20 or more drugs, it is very, very difficult and incumbent upon a good PharmD team to work with the nephrologist, because a lot of times we want to take medications away because the patient's on three drugs, the combination of which causes a side effect for which upon a fourth drug. So, but when we start taking the drugs away, it's just as dangerous as adding them. So taking this lateral pass back from Erica, she mentioned about various organ systems, and that's really important, and it's covered in this paper. So for example, absorption, which impacts the time required for drugs to reach their maximum concentration, that decreases maximum plasma concentrations in patients who have chronic kidney disease. The volume of distribution, which impacts the concentration of the free drug that's available to bind various receptors, that is affected by chronic kidney disease. And of course, the elimination, right? So if a patient has poor kidney function and the drug is removed through the kidneys, then the drug is going to accumulate in the blood. And then there's the issue of, you know, the drug that's accumulating, is it toxic or is it not toxic? So that's what Erica, when Erica said phase two metabolism, that's important. And what's also important is what the drug gets broken down to. So for I'm going to actually pass this back to Erica a second and then ask Lori to chime in. A while back, we started to do a study with an opioid called tapentadol, brand name Nucynta, which only undergoes phase two metabolism. And the metabolites of tapentadol, which is an opioid, are not active. So like oxycodone, for example, has active metabolites. So if there is accumulation of tapentadol, which is metabolized in the liver by phase two, we don't have as much of an issue. So maybe, Erica, talk about some of your experiences with tapentadol in these patients, and then we'll turf it back to Roy for comment on that.
Absolutely. So tapentadol has really become one of our go-to drugs in patients who have failed all other, I would say, non-opioid medications first, because of course we are first going to trial all non-opioids, or if they're contraindicated for our non-opioid preferred medications. So really, tapentadol offers us such a unique mechanism, which is one of the reasons we can find it to be so beneficial in many of our patients, in that it inhibits the reuptake of norepinephrine, as well as acts on our mu opioid receptor. And so we have had some really great outcomes in the use of tapentadol in many of our end-stage renal patients and our hemodialysis patients. And it really affords us a much safer option many times because of the phase two metabolism that Jeff spoke of and not having any active metabolites. So it really has been kind of a game changer in our use with this population.
And as Erica said, you know, it is important this tapentadol, but it is not FDA approved specifically, nor has it been specifically studied in patients with chronic kidney disease or those on dialysis, except for a small study that we did in Albany.
Correct.
It is actually a good opportunity to use an opioid in patients that seems to be relatively safe, at least in comparison to other opioids. So Roy, maybe you can talk about the use of opioids in some of these chronic kidney disease patients and your experience with that.
Sure. And I'll tell you, this is one of the things that I miss with working with you is, you know, we have not used tapentadol at all. And one of the things that I enjoyed when we used to interact, especially in our dialysis population, was this sort of interaction. I mean, you know, you would introduce, and I'll use an example. I don't know if you remember, but you would recommend it half the time when we would use NSAIDs to use etodolac because of their, mildly COX-2 specificity. And you know, that was actually very helpful in some of our dialysis patients because, you know, when we were trying to avoid using some of the NSAIDs, but we didn't really want to use any of the opioids. I mean, you were able to find a lot of those options for us. But in terms of opioids, we really, more recently, we've been trying to get away from use of opioids in these patients. When we were in Albany, there was a fairly high rate of oxycodone, morphine, and even fentanyl use in the dialysis population. And at that time, you know, chronic pain was a little bit more liberally managed with the opioids. So I think that the shift has become where we are really not using opioids almost at all in our end-stage renal disease population. And I think that's actually been somewhat to the detriment because I think we were able to manage chronic pain a little bit more in the past. And there's been a little bit of a loss of that. And there are some, a little bit more suffering that we're seeing in our patients because we are more uncomfortable using it. And we don't have quite as much here, at least, the resource to be able to help manage that, monitor it, and make sure that they can be appropriately managed.
So those are really important pieces that you just brought forward, Roy, particularly with this paper, which focused on the treatment of neuropathic pain, in particular in end-stage renal disease. And the reason for that is that for the non-kidney dysfunction patients, or the normal patients, the mainstay of therapy these days is usually non-opioid therapy, and opioids would be adjunctive medications, or used maybe on a PRN basis. Whereas the mainstay of therapy, as everybody here knows, are usually anticonvulsants and antidepressants. But if the pain is not adequately treated, then we can move on to opioids. And of course, there are certain opioids that conceptually, at least, and scientifically, we would expect to be more efficacious to treat neuropathic type pain, whether the patient has end-stage renal disease or not. So they include things like methadone, which we've all used in our patients before. And methadone is unique in that methadone absorption just naturally decreases through the gut as kidney function decreases. So it's kind of like a safety mechanism. I'm not really sure why that happens, but it does. Methadone is particularly beneficial because it blocks NMDA receptors, also blocks reuptake of norepinephrine, and has opioid activity. The other chemically similar drugs that as Erica pointed out, tapentadol is chemically different than methadone, but pharmacologically it does, as she pointed out, offer blockade of norepinephrine reuptake and is an opioid. And then there's tramadol. So tramadol and tapentadol have a similar chemistry, but tramadol is an ugly drug. We're going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to let Erica talk about that. So again, methadone, tapentadol, tramadol. And another drug that's very rarely used these days is a drug called levorphanol, which has all the attributes to methadone, but it only undergoes phase two metabolism. Methadone can be a disaster in these end-stage renal patients, not because it's a bad drug, but because pharmacokinetically it has very, very complex metabolism, and there's a lot of there's a lot of room for drug interactions because it is metabolized by at least five cytochrome enzymes. So levels can go up, levels can go down. It can affect the levels of other drugs. It is in part dependent on P-glycoprotein for absorption. That's altered in the kidney patient. But so all these things need to be considered. So Erica, maybe you can discuss with us all the disasters that we need to deal with or think about when we dose patients on tramadol.
Tramadol is, I think, a bit of a masquerading drug in a way. A lot of providers will gravitate towards it without understanding, I think, the pharmacokinetics that are involved because it's viewed as being a weak opioid. And in fact, it is. The binding affinity is certainly much lower than that of morphine. But one of the big issues we have is it actually has five different metabolites, one of which is active. And it relies heavily on the cytochrome P450 phase one metabolism that we spoke about earlier to go through this metabolic process. So it initially will go through and is metabolized to three different metabolites and then is further metabolized to two more. And so when you have interruptions in these P-glycoproteins, so heavily it relies on CYP2D6, as well as 3A4, you can have accumulations of your parent drug, or you can have accumulations of your active metabolite. Alternatively, you can also increase your metabolism by inducing some of these P450 enzymes. And so it's really rife with many drug interactions. And then we also come up against the serotonin issue that's involved here. And many of these patients have comorbid disease states. They can have some significant depression. And so oftentimes we'll see patients who come through the clinic and they are being prescribed an antidepressant that has serotonin on board, and then providers don't think about the fact that tramadol has some significant serotonin reuptake inhibition as well. And so that really becomes a pretty significant issue on top of the other metabolic issues.
So there's a great lateral pass back to me again, Erica. So she mentioned antidepressants and serotonin issues, so I'm going to ask Roy about this. So tramadol, as Erica mentioned, requires a lot of CYP metabolism. And in fact, tramadol, also brand name Ultram, is not active when it's ingested. And it doesn't become active until it goes through the first pass in the liver. And the liver utilizes CYP2D6 to convert tramadol to O-dimethyltramadol. And O-dimethyltramadol is the most active form of tramadol. So Roy, I'm going to ask you this question, because I know you teach a lot of medical students and are around all the time and with your licensed colleagues. So you have a patient that comes in and you're trying to decide what medication to put them on. Maybe they're depressed, you decide to put them on an antidepressant, and they're on tramadol. And even if you put them on antidepressant, it doesn't have a whole lot of serotonin property, but it's a 2D6 inhibitor. It is going to prevent the conversion of tramadol to its active form. So in essence, what you're going to be left with is a drug with all the toxicity and none of the benefit. So my question to you, Roy, is that generally speaking, it working with other prescribing clinicians, whether they be specialty physicians, internal medicine, PAs, NPs, how do you feel their general knowledge base is in quickly picking out some of these drug interactions when they're selecting drugs? In other words, do they select medications specifically around those drug interactions when they select them?
That's a great question. I think that is one of the areas where that we could really make improvements in management of our patients. Oftentimes, and I'm included in this. This is not, I'm not trying to throw anybody else under the bus here. It's very hard for us to really keep track, nor do we always have that in the forefront when we're making prescribing decisions. For instance, I don't think anyone, including myself, thinks about, at least with tramadol, is tramadol the active form or is it the precursor form? And will there be something that prevents it from being the active form when we think about prescribing tramadol? Tramadol, like Erica has mentioned, has become sort of the safe pass or the felt to be safe go-to drug because it's purported to be a weak opioid and primarily a peripherally acting opioid. And so I don't think we consider at all, and I rarely ever see people consider, what is going to be the pharmacokinetic effect of adding this medication to that medication? And I think that is an area where, I've been fortunate where oftentimes I'll ask my PharmD colleagues here, I'm thinking about this patient's getting really complicated. I don't really know how many more meds I can add or what I can add. Can you please take a look at this and let me know, what are the possibilities given the profile that they're already on?
Great. So that kind of reminds me also, one opioid that we didn't really discuss specifically that doesn't have any specific pharmacology with regard to norepinephrine or NMDA or anything like that, but a consideration for some of these patients is buprenorphine. Generally speaking, we don't like using buprenorphine or any drugs transdermally in patients with end-stage renal disease because there is some funky stuff going on with that could affect the absorption, transdermal absorption to the skin. But buprenorphine is available, could be used off-label. The opioid use disorder formulations that are the higher dose buprenorphines, they could be used off-label for pain. It's perfectly legal for any provider with a DEA license to do that, which is not the case, of course, with methadone. And then there's Belbuca, which is a buccal film, which is a nice alternative in some of these kidney patients because we don't have to worry about the altered absorption through the stomach and accumulation of buprenorphine. We end up with metabolites that are not generally considered to be toxic. And as buprenorphine accumulates, there's a plateau effect on respiratory depression. So in patients who have kidney dysfunction where we're worried about the accumulation of an opioid, buprenorphine might be a nice alternative because the respiratory depression from buprenorphine is going to plateau because it's a partial agonist antagonist with good intrinsic activity at the mu receptor. So there are a whole host of things, obviously, to consider in some of these patients. Todd, what else can we discuss here?
So I have a question for Erica. Erica, end of stage renal disease patient population, the sensitivity that I'm picking up just in listening to you talk with each other, which I'm in my glory. I can sit here and listen to you guys all day. But there's minimal studies happening in clinical trials, and there's not as much information to really start peeling back the mysterious onion of physiological changes in ESRD population, end of stage renal disease population. Can you kind of give us a little bit information on what those physiological changes are and how that is it's another level of complexity in dealing with these patients?
Absolutely. I think we've kind of alluded to some here and there, but we really haven't hit them fully head on. As Jeff mentioned, you can have some changes in your skin that would prevent or make the use of patch applications not quite as ideal. We often see decline, or we pretty much typically always see decline in our other organ systems, so particularly hepatic. And that is also seen just generally with aging. And so while not all of our end-stage renal disease patients, but oftentimes many of them are older, so we're kind of up against that as well. I think, Roy, if I can pass it over to you and have you piggyback on some of the other things that we see as well.
Sure. A couple of the issues that you had mentioned, it is very interesting. And so with the reduction in renal clearance, we do also see, as you mentioned, changes in hepatic metabolism. There's also obviously changes in the cytochrome system in the GI tract as well, and as well of the absorption of drugs. And then on top of that, the protein binding, because a lot of these patients are hypoalbuminemic, and so you have changes in the circulating fraction. The other thing that happens very frequently in patients on dialysis is their volume of distribution changes chronically. And probably the most dramatic is the volume of distribution in terms of water in the interval between dialysis sessions. You know, most patients gain about 3 to 4 liters, being about, 4 to 5% of total body weight. And so their volume of distribution is changing on a daily basis. And so that can often affect, especially meds that have variable distribution based on either fat or water content. And that's going to affect their distribution as well. So end-stage renal disease especially tends to pose an incredible difficult situation when it comes to drug absorption, distribution, metabolism, and elimination. And so we see multiple factors that play a role here.
Ray made me think of something that we haven't touched on at all, which is shocking to me. But as Roy talked about our changes in volume of distribution, of course, we need to mention the importance of considering drugs that are filtered out. If a patient is on hemodialysis, would be an important consideration. We've mentioned accumulation as well, but that's something that we would really need to keep in mind, is the molecular size as well as the type of filter being used.
Yes, and so great. That's excellent point, Erica. There's a couple of things I wanted to mention to kind of put this in practical perspective. Since both of you brought up various issues with volume distribution, elimination, that sort of thing. So with regard to elimination, as Roy mentioned, the cytochrome P450 system is affected, and in fact, 3A4 is downregulated in these patients. That can cause uremic toxins to build up, which can also cause neuropathic pain. But also very importantly is that all drugs that go to the cytochrome system, about 84% of them go through 3A4. And so if you down-regulate 3A4, that means that any drugs that are metabolized by 3A4, the blood levels will go up. Couple that with the fact that you've got decreased kidney function, that is a big issue. So some of the, Todd asked the question, what's really changing? Well, the nephrons are obviously not working as well. So there's reduced flow to the renal flow in general. There's reduced filtration in general through the glomeruli. And there's reduced tubular secretion. All these things have a direct effect on the majority of drugs that are prescribed. Roy mentioned volume distribution. And I think he mentioned hyperalbuminemia, where patients don't have as much circulating albumin. That's important. So if a patient is on dialysis already, sometimes we will consider putting them on intermittent NSAIDs, right? We're not really worried about damage in the kidneys, but of course, if you give NSAIDs, there are other issues to worry about. But considering that there's less albumin, and that most of these NSAIDs are greater than 92% protein bound to albumin, that means there's more free drug, because the only drug that has activity in the blood is drug that's not attached to a protein. And so now that there's less albumin in these patients, there's more circulating NSAID, it's more toxic, right? The other thing is you get increased concentrations of alpha-glycoprotein. That's important because the TCAs, for example, tricyclic antidepressants, are very highly bound to alpha-glycoprotein. All right, so if you have increased alpha-glycoprotein, then you have less TCA available to do the things that you want it to do. But you have to be very careful about giving too much of that, because if you do, there's a lot of side effects with TCAs. And then I think the other thing is the absorption. So we can increase gastric pH in these patients. And gastric pH is very, very important in determining how much drug is absorbed, whether the drug, when it dissociates from its salt, when it dissociates from its salt, is it a weak acid or a weak base? And based on that, how well it's going to be absorbed orally. And also, how well it's going to be filtered through the kidneys in patients who are not on dialysis but have poor kidney function. There's delayed gastric emptying in these patients, which means that drugs that are absorbed higher up in the gut have more time to be absorbed and their blood levels can go up. And then there's also gastrointestinal edema, which is sometimes problematic in these patients, particularly if they have cirrhosis or they have congestive heart disease and those sorts of things. So there are a whole host of physiological changes in these patients that have chronic kidney disease that need to be considered on top of, all of the very, very specific pharmacological and pharmacokinetic differences of the drugs that need to be considered even in the normal patient. So we really, for a pharmacist, taking care of these patients can be really a full-time job. And I have to say that while I had an opportunity to work with Roy, and I'm sure that Erica would echo this, there are many times that I lacked the expertise on some of the physiology that was going on. And I'd have to turn to Roy and say, listen, you know, I'm kind of thinking about this drug or this class of drugs, but I need to sit down with you and figure out physiologically if this is going to be problematic for another reason that I'm not thinking of. Because I would tell you this, to me, nephrologist is like a clinical physiologist. They are phenomenal at calculations, at doing volumes of distribution, at figuring out the kidney function or dysfunction. They are, in my mind, mathematical whizzes. So I always appreciated that working with Roy, because he really looked at these patients from a different perspective, and it made my job a whole lot easier, and also kept me honest, because, you know, there's just things that as pharmacists we don't have the training in, but of course there are things that as physicians, you know, the medical staff doesn't have the training in. So Roy, you know, thank you for that. I mean, kudos to you guys. You guys are like math wizards in my mind.
Well, I thank you for that. And, you know, I think that's, you know, we definitely complimented each other very well in that regards. I mean, I think that's where the strengths really come into play is, you know, we are responsible for keeping an eye on all of these medical issues that are going on, but all these medical issues are treated pharmacologically for the most part. I mean, we're not cutting these patients open and fixing their problem right then and there. And so that team approach, knowing, you know, what is the myriad of medical problems and how do they interact with each other, and then how do those interactions affect the drugs and the drugs that are going to interact with each other, is really why that, you know, physician pharmacist team is so critical and so valuable in the end-stage renal disease population. And like I said, I mean, I think you have pulled us out of a lot of tight places, Jeff, and I miss having that availability there. And in fact, because I missed that, I'm going to ask you a question, actually. And so I have a patient, actually yesterday I was seeing a patient. The situation that I was rounding, and you know, I have a dialysis patient, and his neuropathic pain is just driving him crazy. I mean, he can't sleep. He's just unable to really tolerate. And again, you know, we don't really have that pharmacy pain management system that we had in Albany. And right now, I think he was just transitioned from gabapentin to amitriptyline, and he really is not doing any better. And so if I were to come to you with this patient, I mean, this is a dialysis patient, you know, having severe neuropathic pain, and it seems to be, that's what he seems to have. And he's on, actually, let me tell you, he's on Topamax and amitriptyline. You know, what would you recommend to me? Give it some time, or?
So what would be happening right now is Erica and I would go into a room and have this discussion, right? So let's go through. This is great that you know we have an actual patient. This is phenomenal. So, all right. So gabapentin, as you know, affects alpha-2-delta subunits in the synaptic cleft, lands on that receptor, closes the calcium channel, and decreases the output of neuroamines in the nerve. So that's one way of doing it. But gabapentin in dialysis patient can be problematic, of course, because it's going to accumulate. You need high doses of gabapentin, but you know, between dialysis sessions, it might peak too high, so it's difficult. So my first thing to you would be, I would ask you, what dose of gabapentin was the patient on?
You know, I apologize. He was not on gabapentin. He's basically on Topamax and amitriptyline.
Okay, but this is a good exercise anyway. Had the patient been on gabapentin, I probably would have said to you, let's give it a trial with pregabalin, because we can get away with lower equivalent doses because it binds more tightly to the alpha-2-delta subunit.
Do you tend to use the supplemental post-dialysis dose with pregabalin as well or not?
Yes. Okay. So what I would do is I would give this patient 50 or 75 milligrams of pregabalin 3 times a week after each dialysis session because it's not going to get filtered out.
Okay.
Right? So that's what I would do. In fact, that's what I'm going to tell you to do right now. the best thing would be to give pregabalin like 50 or 75 milligrams 3 times a week. So not that expensive, right?
Right.
You know, and then you could raise the dose. Amitriptyline, I hate that drug in these patients if we don't have to do it because it has so many anticholinergic side effects. And to answer your question, unlike depression, you can usually see a benefit from amitriptyline or pain within 5 days.
Oh, wow.
I am hesitant to use Topamax in these patients because Topamax relies heavily on the CYP system for metabolism and also can inhibit certain hormones, particularly estrogens, which can be problematic. You know, I'm assuming that this is probably a male patient, but we have a lot of female patients.
Yeah, no, and hormone issues are big issues.
Right, so we need to worry about that. So my suggestion, I mean, I put my head together with Erica, but Eric, you have a lot of these patients, so would you say pregabalin after dialysis, or do you have another suggestion?
Yeah, that's typically such a great starting point. I think you touched on a lot of good reasons there, but one of the biggest is that pregabalin is not going to go through our CYP system, and it isn't, so it's not, you know, not metabolized through the liver, and it's largely not absorbed. But we definitely want to be giving it after our dialysis sessions because I think it's about 50% filtered out. In patients who are dosed on a daily basis that I have seen, and they'll say, "Oh, you know, I feel great, but my pain increases so much after dialysis," and it's because, you know, folks aren't thinking about the fact that you'll see a precipitous drop, and of course they'll have increased pain because of that. So really, I think Jeff is spot on with heading for pregabalin first and foremost, and doing a good trial of that on following dialysis days.
Would you do any sort of tapering off of either the other ones?
What's the dose of those? Do you know?
Topamax is 50 twice a day. And amitriptyline is at 25 at bedtime. I think that was just recently started.
Go ahead, Jeff. Sorry.
You want to answer that question, Erica, or you want me to answer it?
Either way is fine. I'll see what you think, but I wouldn't think that we would need to do too much of a taper off the amitriptyline considering how long that half-life is, and you will have some accumulation.
Okay.
Maybe you would potentially cut it down in half, but Jeff, I would think that owing to those properties, you would kind of almost potentially have a self-taper.
So Erica, you're spot on there. So first I'm going to say this too, but let me first summarize this. So Roy has a patient. Patient has screaming neuropathic pain. Patient is on Topamax 50 milligrams BID and amitriptyline. Has not really responded in any substantial way. And so the question is, like, what would we do? So Eric and I agree that we would give pregabalin either 50 or 75 milligrams 3 times a week. Following dialysis. And then Roy asked the question, what about the drugs that the patient's on? For amitriptyline, I agree with Erica. It has such a long half-life, there's no reason to taper it. You can stop it and the body will taper it all by its lonesome. And it's not all filtered out anyway. It's poorly filtered. So do it depending on the filter. So it's going to stick around anyway in the tissue. And it's going to sort of leach out and be metabolized slowly. So it's a self-taper.
Okay.
With regard to the topiramate, the Topamax, that one I would decrease to 50 milligrams at probably at bedtime for just a couple of days. And then I would just snap those tablets in half and go down to 25 and then stop it. Because sometimes patients get whacked out if you taper Topamax too rapidly. So that's what I would do. But no need to taper the amitriptyline. And Roy, if for some reason you are just compelled and dying to have this patient on a TCA for whatever reason, in my mind at least, the best drug to use in those patients, if you want to get neuropathic pain benefit, is disipramine, right? Because it has less anticholinergic activity.
Okay.
It's almost exclusively norepinephrine and minimal serotonin compared to the other TCAs. And so that's what I would do. If for some reason you wanted to treat depression in a patient and you just love TCAs for some reason, and you didn't want to use an SSRI, then clomipramine pharmacologically is a specific serotonin reuptake inhibitor, but chemically it's a TCA. So if you wanted to get some drowsiness for bedtime sleep, and you were treating depression specifically, not pain, but depression, clomipramine might be a good alternative for some of these patients. So those are the kinds of things. This is great that you threw out that case, right? Because these are the kind of discussions that as a team we would have when selecting the best medication regimen for a particular patient.
Exactly. I mean, this is the kind of case where, you know, the team-based approach that we had was really very helpful. And all the advice that you gave, I mean, this is truly helpful on the real world sense. So I'm very gracious that I was able to stick you right now for this this advice.
And that wasn't rehearsed.
Yes, exactly.
This is the real deal here, podcast land. We collaboration via social distancing and virtual and music. this is a big part of our future. I think COVID-19 is going to teach us about collaboration more so on the technologies that need to be embraced and used. And I thank all of you, Erica. Just enjoyed listening to you, Roy. You all should be coming back. And of course, Jeffrey Feuden, it's just awesome to have you back on the show. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with before we wrap up?
Well, I want to leave them with a hashtag #rebrandpharmacy. #rebrandpharmacy. Because you'll find a lot of information on there that talks about the kinds of unique things that pharmacists do in order to enhance patient care and collaborate with other providers. I just think it's really important to utilize the expertise of pharmacists. And Todd, I want to thank you for allowing our group to come on and talk around various issues on this paper, and also our opportunity to discuss how important it is to work as an interdisciplinary team and to collaborate. No one person could know it all. And if a person says that they do know it all, stay away from them. I'm still learning, right? So again, you know, Todd, thank you so much for the opportunity. I think this was a lot of fun for all of us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming back. We want to have you back. I'd love to get into a deep discussion about artificial intelligence and the leverage of clinical trial acceleration, as well as digital therapeutics being used for complex cases like this, where a wearable could slowly and methodically inject specific properties and medications into the bloodstream of a patient and medications to a patient. Based on the readings that are happening live, ongoing, and these are future things that are coming. But it's fascinating for me to listen to what you're saying and then apply those types of examples to what's coming in the future of pharmacy.
Well, Todd, you know what? Now that you brought it up, you're not going to get rid of me so easy. I actually am working with a company on developing a device which would automatically measure a patient's PCO2 levels and inject naloxone automatically, all of which is trackable and uploaded both to the prescriber of the opioid and the pharmacy. Wow. So that's already in the works.
Well, let's have a future discussion on that, because I've been accused of being psychic before, and I think that I pick up on things. So I would love to have that conversation, and we can surround several other digital therapeutic people that I've created relationships with in the pharmacy space. So I think that would be fascinating.
Great.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Erica and Roy, Jeff, for coming on the Pharmacy Podcast Nation, evidence-based podcasting. We will have all the show notes. If anyone has any questions, you can reach out to Dr. Jeffrey Feudin. That his email will be in the show notes. And as always, we thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast.